Welcome to SickCast, brought to you by Sick Research Institute, illuminating every path.
Hello and welcome to part two of a special episode of the SickCast. My name is Sean Holden, one of your guides to the life and legacy of Ronnie Jindkor, a unique and complex character in Sikh history. Our fountain of knowledge will be Santbir Singh.
I'm a program associate with the Sikh Research Institute, and I'm also a PhD student at York University. But I'm sort of a fan of Sikh history in general, and I like to teach and learn about Sikh history.
If you haven't listened to part one of this two-part series, I recommend hopping over and having a listen. If you're someone who doesn't mind jumping into the middle of things, here is a quick summary. Ronnie Jindkor, coming from a more humble family, captured the interest of Maharaja Ranjit Singh, the prominent ruler of the Sikh Empire. They were married and soon after had a son together named Dilip Singh. However, the Maharaja passed away only a handful of years in their marriage. What preceded was an onslaught of competition and vying for the void of leadership left by the deceased Maharaja. Families of influence, the emperor's sons, and ambitious members of his court resorted to bloodshed to secure themselves on the seat of power. When the dust settled, Ronnie Jindkor had become the regent of a young Dilip Singh, now installed as the new Maharaja. But it came with a heavy cost. She lost her brother to the bayonets of the Khalsa army that respected her. Enterprising British colonizers were eager to take advantage of the unstable political situation surrounding Ronnie Jind and her son. She stood at the head of an army fighting a desperate attempt to hold off a ferocious British invasion. The war concluded with British forces in Lahore and a treaty declaring a British victory. They allowed her and her son to remain as prominent figures still as rulers of the former empire, but as figureheads. Yet it became clear to the British representative Henry Lawrence that one of the most direct threats to complete British dominance was Ronnie Jindkor. That is the backdrop for what is to follow some of the most challenging years that are about to confront her personally.
Very few of those rulers who actually make treaties with the British and let the British control their government ever fight back. Because the British really treat them really well. They let them stay as kings. They give them money. They give them lots of wealth. They let them keep their palaces and their gold and their jewelry and their possessions and all those other things that kings and queens love, you know? So day to day, most people's lives stayed the same. The government just changed. And in fact, in Punjab at the time, the government didn't even technically change. Remember, the Sikh Empire still exists. It's just that they can't do anything now without the British letting them do things. So the taxation system, the way that properties are run, the court system, the day-to-day governance, the different officials that you have, all of those things are staying the same still. And scholars today estimate that $45 trillion were stolen from India by the British in 200 years. India was one of the wealthiest places in the world. Now, that wealth wasn't evenly distributed. It's not like regular folks were very wealthy, but the governments were very, very wealthy. India had a lot of resources, a lot of different mineral resources, farming resources, cotton, wheat, and a lot of gold, a lot of jewels, a lot of other things. So there's so much there in India, the spices and all the silk and all those different things, right?
Now that the war was concluded, the British began rewarding those who helped sabotage the Sikh Empire's forces from within. One such person was the Sikh army's own general, Tej Singh.
So he was going to be rewarded by the British for what he had done, and he was going to be turned into a Raja. Essentially equates to like a prince or like being made a baron in the British system, you know? And Dilip Singh's in charge of the government, so Dilip Singh has to be the one who technically makes him into a Raja as a reward for what he did in the Anglo-Sikh Wars. And the British have told Dilip Singh, you have to do this. And Dilip Singh, at the last moment, he's only like a child of 6 years old at the time, refuses to do this. He refuses to make Tej Singh into a Raja. And the British assume, and probably rightly, that it was Dilip Singh's mother, Rani Jindkor, who had told him not to do this. That Tej Singh has sold out the Khalsa army and not to reward him. and not to make him into a Raja. And so the British are really embarrassed by this moment because they had told the Leipzig to do something. They expected it to be done. And then at the last moment, the Leipzig hadn't done it in front of all of these dignitaries. This for this big ceremony that was going to happen, Leipzig was supposed to become a Raja. And the Leipzig refuses to do it in front of everybody, and the British are embarrassed. And the British assume that it's Rani Jindgor who's behind all this, and they come up with a solution. They believe that as long as Rani Jindgor is there, they will not be able to control the Leipzig. And so their goal is, we want to remove Rani Jindgor from her son and remove her influence from her son. And we want to send her away, so that we can raise the Leipzig how we want to raise him, and so he will be a loyal subject of the British Empire. Technically, he's still a king, but someone who works for the British, essentially. And so the first thing they do is that they lock her up in Summon Tower, which is in Lahore. And then after a couple of months, they send her away to a town outside of Lahore called Sheikhpura, and they send her to a fort there in Sheikhpura. And they lower the amount of money that she gets from the treasury every year. So when the British had taken over, they had made deals with Rani Jindgor and all the other nobles, all the other sardars, and they had said, we will give you this much money every year. We will make sure you get paid this much money every year. She writes a letter, and I've got a quote here from her. And this is a letter that she writes to Lawrence.
As in Henry Lawrence, the British representative in the former Sikh Empire.
I had entrusted my head to your care, and you have thrust it under the feet of traitors. You have not done justice to me. You ought to have instituted an inquiry and then charged me with what you found against me. Why do you take my possessions of my kingdom by underhanded means? Why do you not do it openly? Do justice to me, or I shall appeal to London directly. You have been very cruel to me. You have snatched my son from me. For 10 months, I kept him in my womb. In the name of the God you worship and the name of the king whose salt you eat, restore my son to me. I cannot bear the pain of the separation. Instead, you should put me to death. And Lawrence writes back to her, and he writes back saying, actually, the Leipzig's super happy that and is totally doing fine without you here. And he's a happy kid, and nothing's wrong with him, and you just need to back off, essentially. And she writes back again, and she said, my mind does not believe that the Maharaja is happy. How can he, whose mother has been separated from him, be happy? Weeping, he was torn away from his mother and taken to Shalimar Garden, where his mother was dragged out by her hair. Well has my friendship with you been rewarded. You had been so keen to be the protection of our honor and dignity, but the traitors have robbed us of these also. It is a matter of sorrow that you did not weigh things before accusing me. You have exiled me on the instigation of traitors. Whatever you have done has earned a good name for you. I have lost my dignity, and you have lost the regard of your word. The treatment that you have given me is not even given to murderers. Having renounced everything, I have become a fakir. A fakir is like a monk. But you have not allowed me to even live like a fakir.
Even though she was now in a house arrest, that didn't completely cut her off from the day-to-day politics.
A lot of people really respect her. The Khalsa army, what's left of the Khalsa army, still really respects her. And the regular population really respects her as well. So they sort of lock her up, but she's still able to keep up on what's going on in Punjab. She knows everything that's going on in the government. People are sneaking information to her all the time. So they start to realize that she's still going to be a threat to them, even though locked up in this fort. And she needs to be removed from Punjab completely. First, she's sent to the city of Banaras, which is called Banaras in Punjabi, but Varanasi in English. And when she still keeps trying to be in touch with people in Punjab, they then send her to this fort. It's called Chunar Fort or Chunar Fort, and it's in what's now known as the state of Uttar Pradesh. So this is a letter that Maharani Jindgor writes when she's first sent from Banaras to the Chunar Fort jail. I now commit my course to God and to the vaunted justice of that nation of which you are the representative, and supporting myself with a firm hope of a happy result, I shall endeavor, by meeting the rigor and indignities of my imprisonment in a calm and cheerful spirit, to show that my memory of the forbearance with which the British used the advantage of victory is stronger than my resentment at the severity which their too ready belief in the false testaments of my enemies has induced them to use towards myself. She's speaking up against the British at this point, but she's also still saying to them, it's not fair what you've done to me. And she's under the impression that different people in the court of Lahore have spoken up against her, and that's why the British have sent her away. She doesn't entirely realize that she's been sent away not because of other people in the court who didn't want her there as a rival power, but because the British themselves didn't want her there because they didn't trust her and they thought that she would get in the way of them taking over Punjab.
But things begin to stir outside of the confines of Ranjan Kaur's prison. A few notable figures emerge to the surface.
Four figures have emerged as really not being happy with what the British have done. One is the governor of Punjab called Multan. His name is Dewan Mulraj. The second are two father and son generals, Sher Singh and Jeet Singh Attari. They are not related to Sham Singh, just to make it confusing. And the fourth figure is, remember Bir Singh, the famous Sikh saint who had been killed? The next in line to his data, to his school of thought, is a guy by the name of Maharaj Singh. And Maharaj Singh, he's a saintly figure who's also a warrior. And he's very, very interested in the Sikhs getting their kingdom back and getting their freedom back. And so these four figures start to essentially plan a rebellion against the British.
The four began plotting what would be known as the Second Anglo-Sikh War. Now, this is going to look a lot different than last time. It's not exactly two sovereign nations fighting each other, and looks more like a desperate rebellion.
If the first Anglo-Sikh Wars was ill-fated for the Sikhs, then this one was really ill-fated, unfortunately. They just don't have the manpower. They don't have the troops. They don't have the ammunition. They don't have the number of people needed to actually beat the British, but they are trying their hardest. And their big goal is to free Maharani Jind Kaur and to get the Leap Singh away from the British and reinstall him as the rightful king of Punjab. And that's their big goal.
With Ranjan Kaur's continued incarceration, tensions rise until it reaches a boiling point.
The Second Anglo-Sikh Wars begins with a small dispute in Multan where Dewan Mulraj was in charge. And essentially some British troops were in the city and they disrespected a Sikh flag, the Sikh flag of the Sikh Empire. And the Sikh soldiers killed the British soldiers on the spot. They got into a brawl, essentially, and the Sikh soldiers killed the British soldiers. And then the British then, of course, escalated, and then the Sikh soldiers escalated, and it became an all-out sort of battle. And Multan gets besieged by the British, just surrounded on all four sides by the British army. In the meantime, Jeet Singh and Sher Singh are leading armies to fight the British in other parts of Punjab. And Baba Maharaj Singh, this religious figure, is going around. He's like the organizer behind the scenes. He's going to get people. He's encouraging Sikh soldiers to join the rebellion. He's going from area to area, giving speeches, inspiring people to join the rebellion and telling them to fight back for their rights and fight back for the Sikh Empire. So he's not doing so much of the day-to-day fighting. He is doing some fighting as well, but he's more in the background trying to encourage people to join the rebellion.
There was also now a new British representative. It was a guy named Frederick Currie. And Currie suspected that there was another reason why the Second Anglo-Sikh War took off in the first place, and he points the finger at Ranjan Kaur.
And I've got a quote here from Frederick Currie where he says, "There is no proof, though there is some ground for suspicion, that the Maharani was the instigator of the late violence in Multan. But it is certain at this moment that Divan Muraj, and yes, the whole Sikh army and military population are directed to the Madani as a rallying point of their rebellion or dissatisfaction. Her removal from Punjab is called for by justice and policy, and there's no time for us to hesitate about doing what may appear necessary to punish the state offenders, whatever may be their rank and station, and to vindicate the honor and position of the British government. So this is when she is removed from Benares and sent to the fort directly and sort of imprisoned there when the Second Anglo-Sikh War breaks out. And Divan Muraj puts out an official statement, and his official statement is, "If you know that my Sahiba shall be released and Maharaja Sahib, may he live long and shall reign in his own right, then the keys of the fort of Multan are at your disposal." So essentially he's saying, if you free Madani Jind Kaur and if you let Dalip Singh rule again as a proper ruler, then I will give up this siege. I will give up my control of the fort of Multan and you can take it over. And I'll give up my my battle here. So really, Rani Jind Kaur is the focus of the Second Anglo-Sikh Wars, but she's not actually on the scene. So it's a very interesting situation where they want her to lead them. She wants to lead them, but she's imprisoned. Once the battle breaks out, though, she really goes all in against the British. And she sends a letter to Sher Singh, who's one of the generals leading the rebellion. She says, "100 praises on your gallantry. As long as heavens and earth last, people will talk of your fame. The first thing to be done is to root out the stem, and then you must continue to effect this by punishing the Firangis." Firangi is the word for foreigner in Punjabi. "Used towards these Malechas," also another word for foreigner, but more derogatory, "the same wiles and artifices that they have used themselves and managed by some device to expel them from Lahore. And above all, be confident. They have no force in this direction and are at the dissension among themselves. Encourage all the Hindustanis as much as possible. I sent 2 men to you some time ago who have no doubt reached you by now. My thoughts night and day are fixed on Punjab." She's saying, keep fighting and try to turn over the troops who are fighting for the British to our side, because they are, you know, they might not be fellow Punjabis, but they are Hindustani. They are from South Asia, and maybe they can join us and fight against the British as well.
When the British often arrived in a place like North America, Africa, and in this case, India, they would observe regional tensions and adversaries and see how they could pit those tensions against each other. It made it easier for them to exert their own control. What Rani Jind Kaur is doing is she's acknowledging that strategy and trying to create a united front that can counter it.
There wasn't the sense of, like, we all are South Asians and we all should fight back against the British together. There wasn't that sense yet. That would come much later during the independence struggle against the British in the 1920s and 30s and 40s. At this point, people are thinking of themselves as just from their own little state or their own little area or their own little kingdom. And so this is actually a big deal when she says, you know, get the Hindustanis, encourage them as much as possible. Because she's saying, you know, let's stop thinking in this small way. Let's encourage everyone to join this battle against the British.
Now, Rani Jind Kaur, eager to get out of her imprisonment, finds a way to escape in only 10 days. The leading theory is she managed it by pretending to be one of her own servants.
She somehow escapes from this fort, which is talked about in the literature as this really scary place. And she leaves a letter on the door of the fort on the night she escaped. And she writes in the letter, "You put me in the cage and locked me up. For all your locks and all your guards, I got out. I had told you plainly not to punish me too hard. Now see whether the Punjab shall not be finally settled, and you will begin to realize. But don't think I ran away. Understand well that I escaped by myself unaided. Now don't imagine that I got away like a thief." So she's saying, I didn't escape here like a thief. I escaped like a sovereign, like a queen. I left here of my own free will. So she's really not just escaping in this sort of really amazing way, she's also, you know, really sticking it to them that don't think that I ran away like a thief in the night. I left like a queen. Yeah.
But now on the run and at large, what options did she have to try and lie low?
One of the few sort of independent places left, not again completely independent, also under the control of the British through a resident, is Nepal, which is north of Punjab, right? Quite a bit north of Punjab in the Himalayan mountains. And so in April of 1849, she escapes and she traveled 800 miles somehow evading the British. She traveled from Uttar Pradesh, sort of North India, all the way up to Nepal. We don't know much about her escape. We don't know the route she took. We don't know how she made it. There's a lot of Punjabi folklore around it about different stories of her meeting people on the way and people helping her on the way. None of those are like historically accurate, but there's a lot of sort of legend around it. And she reaches Kathmandu, or Kathmandu as it's pronounced in India, in the end of April of 1849. And she goes there and the Nepali king is just sort of shocked. Like, the former queen of Punjab, the wife of Maharaja Ranjit Singh, has shown up at my door. What do I do? He really respected Maharaja Ranjit Singh, and so he wants to respect her. And he, in fact, decides that he's going to throw a reception for her. He's going to throw a big party for her because she's a visiting dignitary. But the Nepal king is also under the control of a British resident, just like the Sikh kingdom is at the time. And the Nepal king was going to hold this dinner for her in 1850, in March 8th of 1850. So she reaches there in April of 1849. And so she's there for about a year. He's going to throw this big party for her. But the British resident says, and I quote, "discourage in future any intention which I may observe in this court to recognize publicly this restless and intriguing lady." So they tell the king not to recognize her, not to support her. He says, "I'm still going to support her because she was Maharaja Ranjit Singh's widow and I respected Maharaja Ranjit Singh, but fine, I won't give her a platform and I won't give her too much money." So he puts her up in a house. He gives her some money. She brought a whole bunch of jewelry with her when she escaped out of jail, and she uses that money to live also. Essentially, is trapped in Nepal. And she sends letters to Punjab to find out what happened to the rebellion, to the Second Anglo-Sikh Wars. And the news that she gets back is heartbreaking. Not only has the rebellion failed, and the rebellion did eventually fail, Sher Singh and Jait Singh surrender, Diwan Mool Raj surrenders, and the fort of Multan is taken by the British. Baba Maharaj Singh, that saintly figure who was fighting, lasts longer and keeps fighting, but eventually someone close to him sells him out. He is captured and imprisoned. The British don't know what to do with him because he's so well respected by the people and so loved as a religious figure that instead of giving him a proper trial or locking him up or doing anything like that, they send him to Singapore and they lock him up in a tiny prison cell, which is less than 8 feet across. And they keep him locked up in a prison cell in the middle of the jungle for the next few years till eventually he dies in the jungle, just from mistreatment. Jait Singh and Sher Singh are also sent out of Punjab. So all of the different leaders that had led the rebellion are captured and exiled out of Punjab. Rani Jind Kaur has already been exiled out of Punjab, obviously. Now, the British response to the rebellion is a really interesting one. And this is where, you know, Sikhs still have a lot of resentment towards the British, I would say. Because the British always claimed that they were acting according to laws, and they always had the sort of claim that they only attacked the Sikhs in the First Anglo-Sikh Wars because the Sikhs had invaded, right? But in the Second Anglo-Sikh Wars, they took over and they were running the government, they beat the rebels, and then they said, actually, this wasn't a rebellion, this was the government of Punjab working against us. And in response to this, we are going to depose Dalip Singh as the king of Punjab, and we are going to annex the government directly, and we are going to get rid of the Sikh kingdom. this is taking off the map. This is getting rid of the Sikh Empire completely, even in a sort of symbolic sense. This is Dalip Singh being taken off the throne of Punjab. This is the second Treaty of Lahore from 1849. And in the second Treaty of Lahore in 1849, Dalip Singh is forced to sign the treaty. He's 7 years old at the time. He loses his kingdom and the Sikh Empire is officially finished. And Jint Kaur is in Nepal at the time. And she finds all this out after the fact. After this, she didn't really have anybody to send letters to. There was nobody left, right? She still tries to get in touch with people in Punjab, but she's increasingly isolated in Nepal. The Nepali king and her start to sort of quarrel more and more. The Nepali king gets more and more sick of her being there. I can't get rid of her. I have to treat her with respect because she's a former queen. But at the same time, the British are mad about her being here, and I don't know what to do about her. She keeps trying to get people to join her in her rebellion. So she even goes to two figures who you would least suspect would help the Sikhs. She sends letters to the Afghani king. And remember, Afghanis and Sikhs had been enemies for a long time before this. But the Afghani king was also semi-independent at the time from the British. And she sends letters to him and says, you know, if you attack Punjab, we'll help you and we can get rid of the British together. And remember, Gulab Singh had taken over Kashmir and he was semi-independent in Kashmir. She sent letters to Gulab Singh as well and said, you know, if you help me, we can defeat the British and you can be a real ruler if you want and we can work together to defeat the British. So she's really trying to play all her cards. There's no one left in Punjab to fight. She's trying to get people outside of Punjab to fight the British for now.
Rani Jint Kaur desperately wants to be back with her son, and he couldn't be further away. But now that Dalip Singh was deposed, he was going to be taken even further from her.
Essentially, his kingdom is taken from him. He was put into the care of a Dr. John Logan, and he stays in Punjab for a number of years. So we're talking about 1849. So at that point in 1849, Dalip Singh would be about 11 years old. And Dr. John Logan is a devout Christian, and he really takes it on himself to try to convert Dalip Singh. So what occurs after that is they decide that it'd be best if Dalip Singh actually left Punjab completely. And they send him to England in late 1854 and introduced to Queen Victoria. And Queen Victoria takes a liking to him. And he actually stays with the royal family for a while. And then he gets bored and he wants to go back to India, but they don't let him go back to India. And instead, he is given an annual pension from the British government, which works out to, in today's money, about $2.5 million, as long as he, quote, remains obedient to the British government. And he is given a castle to live in, and that's where he spends the next few years of his life. So he's in a whole nother continent, a world away. He's left his religion. He's given up his culture to a large degree. He's living like a British man, essentially, in England, and his mother's still in Nepal, and she's still pining for him. And I don't think she even realizes at this point that he is in England, that he's not in Punjab anymore. Eventually, she does realize that he is not in Punjab, and she's able to get messages to him in England. And there's a change in the British government in India at the time. So we're jumping ahead quite a bit now, and we're getting to 1860s right now. So it's been 11 years since the end of the Second Anglo-Sikh Wars. Dalip Singh is in his early 20s by now. Rani Jint Kaur has been in Kathmandu for over a decade, sort of in this house arrest situation. And the British government thinks she's not really a threat anymore. They decide that, you know what, let's let her actually meet her son. She's not going to cause problems for us anymore. She's an old lady now. She's lost that sort of fire that she had. In January of 1861, Dalip Singh actually visits India. And he doesn't visit Punjab, but he visits India and he comes to Calcutta. We don't have too many notes about what that meeting was like, but what we do know is that there were some Sikh soldiers in Calcutta at the time who found out that Dalip Singh was in Calcutta. And they start to gather at the hotel where he's staying, saying, "Let us see our king, let us see our king." And the British kind of freak out and they realize even all these years later, even though he's been deposed, even though he's converted to Christianity, even though he is not a Sikh anymore, there's still so much loyalty and passion towards him and his family by the Sikh masses that they quickly decide that he should leave India and that he shouldn't be allowed to stay in India. And this is a quote from the British resident in Kathmandu. He says, quote, "Madani Jind has much changed, was blind and had lost much of her energy which formerly characterized her." So Rani Jind Kaur, I'm not sure if it's due to imprisonment or something else, but for some reason she loses much of her eyesight during this time. And by the time she meets up with her son, she's almost blind. She's really sort of lost a lot of her energy and her strength. She's not fighting to get back to Punjab anymore. She's now just desperate to see her son and to be in touch with him once again. And so the British decide, you know what, we'll let her finally see her son. And they let her go to Calcutta. And there she's finally reunited with Dalip Singh. Rani Jind Kaur is 44 years old when she finally reunites with her son, which isn't that old, but she's really deteriorated in her health over her 10 years in Nepal. And she seems to be, in a lot of ways, a broken woman. Her kingdom has been taken from her. Her son was taken from her. You know, she desperately tried to support the rebellion of the Second Anglo-Sikh Wars, and that didn't work out. And she's essentially, in a lot of ways, given up on trying to get back to Punjab and get back the Sikh kingdom. And so Rani Jind Kaur is given is sort of in a predicament. She can either stay in India separated from her son again, or she can return with him to England. She doesn't want to go to England. She, you know, this is sort of the heart of the beast of the empire that's destroyed everything that she's had. But at the same time, she said that she doesn't want to be separated from her son again. And so instead, she decides that she's going to go to London with her son. And so she reaches England in 1861. And this is a quote from the wife of John Logan, the man who was responsible for Dalip Singh and who had converted Dalip Singh to Christianity. And her name, she's called Lady Logan. And Lady Logan had heard so much about Maharani Jind Kaur's beauty and influence and strength. And so she was really curious to meet this woman, to meet Rani Jind Kaur. And when she met her, this is her quote. She said, "Her compassion was aroused when she met this tired, half-blind woman, her health broken and her beauty vanished. Quote, "Yet the moment she grew interested and excited in a subject, unexpected gleams and glimpses through the haze of indifference and the torpor of advancing age revealed the shrewd and plodding brain of her who had once been known as the Messalina of the Punjab." So she still has that fire within her. Once she starts talking about a topic that she's interested in, that she's passionate about, that passion sort of comes back to her. And you can see the strong woman is still there. She wants to stay with her son, but the British government convinces her son that she should instead be put up in a house a little bit away from him in the area of Kensington, which is in London. And so she's put out into a house in Kensington where she has a maid who takes care of her. And she gets to see her son quite often, but her life is essentially very lonely at this point.
Now that she is finally reunited with Dalip Singh, she can begin teaching him about his legacy, about his father, about the Sikh empire, and the faith that he was born to.
So she has a dramatic impact on Dalip Singh's life, actually. She teaches him about his heritage. Remember that he was, you know, 7 years old when he was when the British took over. And even before that, he was raised in the chaos of Punjab in the wake of Ranjit Singh's death, you know, of all the murders and and the backstabbing that had happened in Punjab at the time. And so she teaches him about his heritage as the son of Mata Ranjit Singh and also his heritage as a Sikh. Dalip Singh finds out about his religion. He finds out about his traditions. He finds out about his family. She really has a dramatic impact. You know, when he was converted to Christianity, he didn't understand what the Sikh tradition was because he hadn't been living among Sikhs. He didn't know what Sikhi was at the time. And so this is sort of the first time in his life that he's learning about the Sikh faith and Sikh traditions.
With her declining health, Rani Jind Kaur passes away on August 1st of 1863.
She passes away in London, and you can actually find a plaque outside the house where she passed away. It's called Abingdon House in Kensington in London. She sort of just passes away peacefully in her sleep one night. And she says in Punjabi, mere haddiyan is nirde tarti vich na rolo jaan, that don't let my bones be allowed to rot in this merciless land, and that her dust should be returned to the dust of her motherland. So she asks that she not be allowed to be buried in England, that she wants to be cremated and be cremated in India. And Dalip Singh takes her remains the following year in 1864 to Bombay, and he's only allowed to go to Bombay. He's not allowed to go further into India. He's not allowed to go to Punjab to cremate her in Punjab, which is what she really wanted. But he's at least able to cremate her in South Asia, in India. And on the banks of the Godavari River, in a place outside of Bombay called Nasik, she's cremated in 1864. And a small samad is built there. And a samad is essentially a tomb, essentially, for the ashes that are sometimes built for prominent figures. And in 1864, a year after his mother passes away, he is initiated into the Khalsa tradition and becomes a Sikh once again. So he receives Amrit, you know, which is a term we use for when you join the Khalsa and you become an initiated Sikh. There actually was a large plan for him to come to Punjab and be reinitiated into the Sikh faith in this large ceremony, which would be witnessed by, you know, regular Punjabi folks, regular Sikhs, and it would sort of be this dramatic return to the tradition. But the British wouldn't let him go back to Punjab. And so he ends up converting to Sikhi, not in India, but in Egypt, actually. Where he is trapped on the way of trying to get to India. He had only returned to India twice since he had left India. Once was in 1860 when he brought his mother back to England, and one was in 1863 when he brought her remains to India to cremate them. But he was never able to step foot in Punjab. He was allowed into India, Calcutta the first time and Bombay the second time, but he was never allowed to return to Punjab.
The legacy of Rani Jind Kaur wouldn't end with just Dalip Singh. In some ways, the next generation would carry her torch forward.
Dalip Singh himself, though he left this sort of sad legacy behind, he did have children. The last surviving member of Ranjit Singh's family was a young woman named Princess Bamba Sutherland, who was Dalip Singh's daughter. And she lived in London and eventually moved back to Punjab. But when she was in England, she was actually an early suffragette. And she was involved in the suffragette movement of getting women the right to vote in England. And she later in life returns to India, and she finally is able to go to Bombay and find her grandmother's ashes. And in 1924, she brings them back to Lahore, where they are now kept in the samad, in the building where Mata Ranjit Singh's ashes are kept. Rani Jinskor's ashes are returned to Punjab and are reunited with her husband. And her granddaughter actually ends up living in Lahore and stays there and was actually involved with revolutionaries for independence. And she lived until 1957 after Punjab, after the British left India. So she got to see a free India eventually. Rani Jinskor's granddaughter did.
So what are some of the reflections we can have about Rani Jinskor's life? She came from humble beginnings, but despite that, became a prominent figure within her entire society that relied on her. She saw her people through one of the darkest days of its entire history, and she kept her dignity during some of her own. It may seem in the end that she had a tragic end to her story, but the generations that follow shed a brighter light of who she was.
Yeah, and Rani Jinskor herself has become a much celebrated figure. You know, during the independence movement, her story started to be told, and her tragic story became a source of inspiration for Sikhs fighting against the British. And even today, a century and a half after her death, she is well remembered by the Sikh community and remembered as a noble figure, someone who dedicated her life to the independence of the Khalsa kingdom and who tried desperately to see that kingdom be free once again. So she has had an incredible legacy. And, you know, we've talked about earlier how her legacy is somewhat mixed as well. There are people who believe that she may have played a more nefarious role when the British first took over. But I think that even if that were true, and we can't know for certain whether that's true or not, her behavior after the fact was always struggled, you know, quite strongly for a independent Sikh state and for the independence of the Sikh kingdom. History is written by not only the victors, but it's also written by those who play a dominant role in society, and those marginalized voices don't get heard very often. So even within Sikh history, we've lost a lot of stories of Sikh women. We know that they were there, but we only have, you know, the remnants of a few famous figures, and we don't know the day-to-day lives of Sikh women throughout the 18th and 19th centuries. Rani Jinskor is one of these few figures whose story we do know. I think of her as someone who struggled and kept fighting. And even when she was this quote unquote broken woman, half blind, her beauty behind her and all that, as she's described when she's in England, she still is able to inspire her son to return to his faith tradition and return to Sikhi and try desperately to come back to India after her death. That's how she's remembered. That's her true legacy. And even though she wasn't successful in her lifetime, eventually the British did leave India. And it was largely because of Sikh activism. You know, Sikhs played a huge role in the independence struggle against Britain. You know, 80% of the people who were arrested during the independence struggle were Sikhs, and 90% of the people who were executed by the British during the independence struggle were Sikhs as well. It was the memory of people like Rani Jinskor that was one of the inspiring figures for the independence struggle against the British. It's hard to see someone's legacy unless we take a step back sometimes. If you had asked in 1865 what Rani Jinskor's legacy was, you'd probably say she didn't have much of a legacy. She's got this little samadhi where her ashes are kept in Bombay, far from Punjab, and she doesn't seem to have had much of an impact. But now, looking back 150 years later, she seems to have had quite a dramatic impact and is well remembered by the Sikh community even today. So sometimes people's legacies are complicated and they can take a while to have that impact. And I think is someone who we should learn about as Sikhs in the 21st century. Not only because her life gives us insight into the fall of the Sikh kingdom and the rise of British colonialism, but also it's an inspiration of how one can hold on to their nobility and their grace and their courage in really difficult circumstances.
That concludes part two of our special series on the life and legacy of Ranjan Kaur. I've been your guide, Sean Holden, joined by Santbir Singh, and this is the Sikh Cast. I hope you walk away with some reflections on this important figure from Sikh history. And lastly, I want to thank you for taking the time to listen to her story.
You are listening to SikhCast by Sikh Research Institute, illuminating every path.